Emma?
Hey, how's it going?
It feels like the internet wants to learn how to code, the whole entire internet. I know people ask you for help and they want to get started. And when they do, what do you tell people? Like, if they're just getting started, what do you tell people in terms of learning how to code?
I get several messages from people who say, you know, oh, I'm thinking about, you know, making a huge career shift, or, oh, like my wife or my husband or my friend is thinking about making the shift. Like, should they do it? And I always say absolutely, but you have to go in being aware of the fact that it will take dedication. Like, you can't join any field and not put in the time and effort, right? This just so happens to be a field where you can teach yourself everything that you need to be successful, and you can do it for little to no money at all, which is incredible, but that doesn't mean you don't need to put in the hours. So there are a couple of resources I would suggest people to start with. One is Free Code Camp, because it's awesome and it's amazing and it's free. And Quincy Larson has done an incredible thing building that community. I actually used it the other day. I went and took the entire regex thing, and then I made that blog post that like blew up the internet, because no one understands regex, right? Just because I've been in this industry and just because I went to school for computer science doesn't mean that I don't still have trouble understanding certain things. So I would recommend Free Code Camp. Also, there are so many podcasts out there, like Egghead Podcast, obviously, is a great place to start. The Free Code Camp, Code Newbie, and also the Change Logger, all really great ones I found recently.
I love Wes Botza's Syntax FM too. I think theirs is really good as well.
Yeah, there are so many, and I don't have enough time to listen to all of them. I need to make more time.
So, yeah, it's like a massive stack.
I know. Yeah. And there are so many blogs out there. I got to say, Ben Halpern is killing the game with his practical dev site. There are a lot of great posts for beginners on there.
That's dev.to.
Yeah,
right?
dev.to. Yep. My biggest piece of advice would be, don't get overwhelmed.
Like, that site in particular to me is really interesting. I'm trying to figure it out, because it's like, you get there and it's a stream of posts, and what they're allowing everybody to do is basically use it as a syndication platform as well as an original content platform. And it's almost overwhelming at first, but once you start like paying attention, I think the patterns emerge. And I know you spent time on there, and I was wondering, like, how do you use dev.to personally? Like, what's your reading and writing habits on that site?
I subscribe to like all of the topics like JavaScript, and I like the discussion ones too, because I like to have discussions with people and learn new things. But anything tech related goes on dev2. I find personally, I was actually asked the other day, like between Medium and dev2, like which one do I prefer, like what are the differences. In terms of technical blog posts, I highly recommend Practical Dev. I feel like the engagement is much higher, because you're really only getting developers on there, right? Versus Medium is kind of like the entire universe is on there, and I never get as much engagement. I also find the platform way easier for like code snippets and embedding different mediums, for lack of a better term, into it. So yeah, I would say there's so many awesome people on there as well. Like, everyone on there is doing great work. And I do like the discussions part, because I think then it opens up the door to like knowledge sharing, versus Medium is really just a place for like static posting. The comment section really, at least in my experience, has never been a conversation starter.
I'm just going to say it. I think Medium's garbage, and nobody should put any of their content on there ever. That's me. That's my opinion. That's where I'm at with that particular website.
Yeah, I had a love-hate relationship with it. The one thing I did like was that I could write drafts and they would like auto-save. Like, that was super useful for me, because
design wise, it's amazing. Like, it's a beautiful site. I mean, it's homogenous. Yeah. Everything kind of looks the same. The editing experience is pretty cool. They've started randomly throwing paywalls up on content that you've put up there in the past. And, you know, not necessarily like sending out checks. They do stuff like that. I just don't like, I feel that in some ways the same about YouTube. Honestly, like, that's, you know, like, in that's why we do Egghead, right? We want to make a place where developers can go and put their content up there, and it's not like driving people away from your content. I don't know, does that make sense? Like, it's not an ad platform, because there's nowhere Medium can ever go outside of being an ad platform, because, you know, they've had like $135 million in investment, and those people want return. So, you know,
right
you know, how are they going to get that? And you know, we are the product, our words are the product, so, you know, own your words is my advice. Like, dev2 does it differently, because they're allowing you to do canonical URLs, right? Like, so you can like still get credit for your work, I think is important.
And I like, to be honest, I like the way that they socially interact with the community. Like, they always retweet the blog posts that people post, and they're very active in that. And I think that's great. Like, if I'm on a platform, like, the fact that they will help me grow as an author, like, that's just pretty incredible. To me, it kind of feels like I don't hate Medium. I think that there are a lot of benefits to it, but it does feel like there's more of an I don't want to say ego. It feels like a very pretty rigid, right? Like it's a nice minimalist concept, but like there's not as much room to be creative or like differentiate yourself, I wouldn't say. I think, yeah, I'm migrating all my tech ones over.
Well, Ben and the rest of that company are doing a really amazing thing. They don't, you know, they are taking basically donations to run the site and, you know, some sponsorships, but it's not, there's not like this huge push for them to monetize what they've done. And I have so much respect for what they've built. And I love the community because it feels like a community versus Medium, which is you're just going there to drop a post.
It's a business. Right.
Yeah. You're going to drop a post and take off and hopefully you get some engagement and increase your brand or whatever. You know, they've been getting a lot of flack lately too. I'm not the only person yelling at Medium right now, but I don't want to pile on too much.
No, I know. Misconception that I will say I hear all the time is like, what should I blog about? Or like, why should I blog about a topic if someone's already written it? And there's kind of twofold. One, you don't have to blog. Like there are a ton of different ways that you can share your knowledge with the world, whether that's with like GitHub projects, open source contributions, YouTube videos, like find your niche and like own it, right? You don't have to blog. Mm-hmm. And second thing is like, just because a topic's been written about doesn't mean you don't have a unique experience. Or for like, not double negating myself, just, you know, if you have knowledge, share it. Like someone will find use out of it. So,
I actually run into this a lot and we get, you know, people that want to create content on AKAD and it's like, well, there's another lesson. Somebody's already said this. And to me, I think almost every perspective is unique and not, you know, if you're not plagiarizing, if you're taking like the amalgamation of the resources you've looked at and then running that through the funnel of your experience, your voice is valid. It's like, is there too many tutorials on Lodash on the internet? Like how many Lodash tutorials probably exist? And if you write another one, is that too many? And the answer is no. Like people want multiple sources and they want to hear multiple voices and see multiple opinions on things.
So. Well, it's funny because like I'll do like one of those Twitter polls. I'm like, oh, do you guys want to see a blog post on, cat breeds? And everyone's like, no, like there are like 1,000 blog posts on cat breeds. And other people are like, well, like it's free content. Like, why are you saying no? And it's true. It's like, why would you really say no to more knowledge? I mean, it is what it is. You know, maybe my words help someone who up until that point couldn't grasp the concept. But I was having a conversation with my husband earlier in the car and we're talking about like unique ideas. And it's like we're in the day and age where almost no idea is completely unique, right? So like, how do you be unique and not plagiarize? And one of the best ways to do that, I forget who said it. I feel like it was Sarah Drasner, but I could be wrong. So don't quote me on this. But someone said that to create unique content, you know, it's okay to read what other people have written or watch what they've created and then think about it for a day or two and let it sink in and then kind of not regurgitate it. But like, if you were to explain this to someone, how would you explain it? And at that point, like you've digested it enough and like formed your own opinions about a topic to where it is a unique opinion on it. So it's definitely a balancing act though.
Yeah. I mean, well, it's in your own words, right? Like if you are one, if you're, you know, like obviously cutting and pasting, like don't do that. And if you do that, put it in a block quote and give credit and add a link, like, which is fine too, right? Like if you're just like, hey, I'm going to express my understanding of this concept. And to me, like I do that with emails or whatever. Like if somebody says something to me, I want to like repeat it back to them so that to make sure that I understand it in a way that makes sense to both of us. And it's similar in a lot of ways. It's almost conversational.
Absolutely.
So something I've heard you talk about is this idea of being T-shaped as a developer, and I was wondering if you could tell me more about what being T-shaped means and why that's a benefit and why that's something that we should think about.
The general concept behind being T-shaped is twofold. So one, you have a breadth across a discipline. So like for example, I would call myself T-shaped in the sense that I have a breadth of knowledge about development and design as a whole. So I have some working knowledge of UX design and visual design. I have some working knowledge of database and APIs. And then it's the second part where you have a depth within a certain discipline or like an area of expertise. So like I would say my area of expertise is primarily in the front end, right? Like I would say maybe towards accessibility. That would be like my deep vertical knowledge. So being T-shaped is important because while, you know, expertise in one specific knowledge area is extremely important, if you are, you know, kind of living in this silo where you're not, you don't have any core, like, competence across, you know, other disciplines, it can get really hairy when you need to, like, integrate or create, like, a full stack application. Like, okay, let's say I have a vertical knowledge of, like, building a front end, like, website, but now I need to hook it up to a database. And if I have no knowledge of, like, what even is a database or, like, where do I even start, like, that can get pretty hard. So, you know, gain a lot of knowledge in a lot of different areas. It doesn't have to be deep. It can be pretty surface level.
Like vocabulary almost.
Yeah. Right? Like, I mean, I took one database course when I was in school, and like, I know enough to be able to have a conversation about like, okay, what is a relational database? What is this thing that people are freaking out called GraphQL? Like, to be able to have like a high level conversation is very valuable. And I would say it makes me a better developer and it makes other people better developers. So yeah, just because like something isn't exactly your area of expertise doesn't mean you shouldn't go out and learn it if it interests you.
Yeah. So when we're learning stuff, it often means we need to get out there and we're asking questions and we're trying to figure it out. And I think part of that, you know, it's like having the vocabulary, like you're talking about, and that's your horizontal knowledge. Mm-hmm. And like asking good questions is so important. And I was wondering, have you had any experience like asking good questions versus asking bad questions?
Oh yeah. And only because I've asked terrible questions during my life.
Yeah, me too.
That's a, no doubt. You know what? It's a skill that's not appreciated enough, is asking good questions. Like it was at the point where like where I would not even take the time to try to find an answer before I would just go bother my coworkers. And that's just like a disservice to both of us, right? Like I'm not, you know, trying to help myself at all and I'm wasting their time. So let's say you're solving a problem and you get stuck. The first thing you should do is write out a list of things you know that you need in order to solve this problem, right? And then from there, like, what information do you already know? And then what pieces of information are you missing? And then the next thing is, like, how do you find this missing information? And this kind of leads into problem solving. And I believe Allie Spittle is going to come out with a problem solving course. So you should go check her out if you haven't. This is an area I always struggle with. What questions do you ask when you don't even know where to start?
Right.
So, if you want to ask a good, like, well-informed question that you'll get a lot of benefit from, you have to first try to solve it. And once you're stuck, right, like, don't, like, sit around on a problem for 2 weeks. If it gets to the point where you're spending, like, an hour or more on a problem that could be solved within 5 minutes of talking to a coworker, like, at that point, you should probably go and just talk to someone. But do make sure that you've done a little bit of, like, high-level research and you're well-informed enough to be able to have a discussion and you're not just going to say, hey, like, how do I, you know, find an element in an array? Like, how do I grab an array element? Like, that's the kind of stuff you should know enough to be like, all right, well, like, I know I'm working with an array. Maybe I'll start with the documentation and I'll look through there and see what methods are available. But one thing that I would suggest is if you're going to ask a question, keep it simple. If you make a question overly complicated and have several parts, it's going to be kind of confusing. So I would suggest like find out what pieces of information are missing to solve your problem and then ask very simple questions. Because once you break it down,
a paragraph versus an essay.
Yeah. Like if you break it, like that's even how you would like construct a blog post or like a talk, right? Is like break it into the bullet points. That's essentially what you want to do with a problem that you're trying to solve, is like break it into bullet points, have one line be one piece of information and like go from there.
Yeah. One of my favorite, I think, all-time resources for asking questions on Stack Overflow, they have a How to Ask article. They actually have an entire section of their help center revolved around asking, but this How Do I Ask a Good Question article is really great and pretty simple in and of itself. And like, oh, yeah, I've been asking bad questions. Yeah. I need to like up my question asking game. And like the benefits of that are immense. One, I think people answer you more and you get better answers, but then they also know that you respect them and respect their time because you ask good questions and they're just more apt to, you know, like allow you that. Because I think, you know, we have like social credit.
Absolutely.
With people, and if you know when you ask a question you're drawing from that, so that's something to be aware
of.
That's
so true.
Yeah,
I never thought about it like that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, like if you're going around and you know, you get people always want mentors, right? Like I see this so much, and you'll get you know emails or direct messages or whatever, and it's like, hey, will you be my mentor? And I think that's such a to me, it's like an odd question. I understand where it comes from, but like it isn't, I don't think it's the way to start that. Right. Like that's really that question should be something different. Like, how do you like ease into that? And have you seen this, like the idea that everybody wants and needs mentors and they're asking for it specifically, will you be my mentor?
Yeah, for sure. And I get messages like this, and while I would love to help everyone,
yeah,
the problem with saying like, will you be my mentor is, well, what type of mentorship are you looking for, right? Like for me, like I would always, let's say I wanted to enhance like my web animation skills. And so I messaged Sarah Drasner and I was like, hey, can you be my mentor? Like that doesn't tell her anything that I'm looking for. But if I'm like, hey, I saw your course on, you know, web animations. I think that you're really well versed in this. Would you have time for maybe like one ad hoc session mentorship where like I can send you maybe a list of questions ahead of time and then we could just have a little discussion about it. And if you respect someone's time enough to do the heavy lifting, like on the mentorship side, like, yes, mentorships are a two-way street, right? Like you can both learn things from each other, but realistically, the person asking for the mentorship is typically a mentee looking to get the majority out of this relationship. And as a result, like the majority of the responsibility should be on them to do the preparation. So as opposed to saying, will you be my mentor? Say like, hey, you know, I see that you're well-versed in A, B, and C. I'm looking to enhance my skills in these. If I send you over a couple of questions, would you be able to like help me understand them? And that's always what I tell people is like, hey, I don't have a ton of time for like a mentorship, right? Because like that term is so broad. But if you have specific questions, I am more than happy to help. Like I'll get on a little call with you or I'll send you, you know, messages, whatever. But yeah.
So, I mean, all of your work that you've done, like all of the blogging that you've done, all of this work that you've put out there is to me literally and very, very pointedly a form of mentorship. If somebody wants to like go learn from you and learn what you know, like just your practice that you've done has provided that for people. And to me, the same is true. Like Sarah, I can't even imagine what her inbox looks like. I right. try to imagine it and it completely blows my mind. But if you think about what Sarah's done and where she's like produced, you know, content, what the front end masters stuff, which is amazing. And you can literally pay her via front end masters to get what to me is very, very close to mentorship. Mm-hmm. And I understand everybody wants bespoke, right? Like I want you to hear my problems and I want to be heard.
Right.
But at the same time, like if you record something, whether it's video or a book, Sarah has a great book, you know, like all that stuff is a form of mentorship. And if you've consumed all that and your questions are so, you know, like deep that you need to contact that person, one, you have to know if they're in the advice business because a lot of people aren't. And so I say pay people to be mentors, like that's fine, but that's if they are in the advice business and say, hey, you can pay me to be your mentor. But if that specific person can't, maybe you can pay somebody else. And like I've paid almost every single mentor I've ever had.
Yeah.
Like cash, like for their time. And I say that and then people will email me and be like, hey, can I pay you to be my mentor? And I'm like, that's not what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like that's not what I'm saying. Like I'm, you know, that isn't how it works, but you know, it's like, why don't you look at the sum whole of what's available? People are just so like need direction, just as a species, we crave direction and personal attention, where our problems aren't necessarily unique.
I never thought about like content producing as a form of mentorship, and you're not the first one to say this, but like now that you mention it, it's true. It's like asynchronous mentorship if you think about it. I personally produce content because I need to learn a skill, and like once I learn it, I want to share that with the world, but also like remember it for myself, like that regex thing. Like everyone's like, oh, like you understand regex. I'm like, no, I really don't. Like I created that so I could go back and look at it later.
There's 15 minutes there where you really understood regex, but now you're gonna have to reference your own article.
Exactly.
The best is when your own article comes up in your Google search. Like that's the, like to me, you know, like that's the biggest smile on my face ever.
It's so funny though, because like sometimes I'll reread my articles. I'm like, oh my God, I'm so smart. Like, oh my God, I wrote this. Like, who am I? And like, then I'm like, oh crap. Like I need to write better posts because like recently I've been slacking. This old stuff is real great. Yeah. Like, I mean, that's a good feeling though. Like when you reread your old stuff and you're like, oh, like I've learned a lot. And it's part of my blog posts too are like almost a form of like therapy for myself, because like, at least like not the super technical ones, but like the higher level ones that just talk about like the industry, like, oh, like how to write a cool resume to get hired in the tech industry, or like how to do great on your interviews. Like these are almost a form of like therapeutic form of they help me process my feelings and like experiences in this industry.
I mean, it's a journal, right? Like at the end of the day, and exactly. And it's professional. Exactly. So it's a professional journal and you're writing it in a certain way for, you know, the broader internet, but it's for you. I write for myself.
Right.
Like first and foremost, you know, like exactly. I'm the audience.
A lot of people are like, oh, like how do you get followers on social media? Like, how do I get people to my blog? And I'm like, well, the first step is don't write content for the sole purpose of having other people read it. Write content or like, okay, that came out wrong. But like write content because you love it and you're interested in it, not because you want to get views. And I think that's the biggest misconception is like, okay, if you think the public wants to hear about topic X and you don't even like that topic, no one's going to want to read your stuff. If you don't want to read your own stuff, no one else will, right? So write about the things that you're passionate in or like make videos about the stuff that you love and then people will be drawn to that.
Yeah. And I mean, people want one, they want experts, but they also want authenticity. That's important. So, you know, like you can be out there and there's all sorts of ways to kind of fake it or work on your personal brand. And like I employ content strategy, like I get all that stuff. But at the same time, you know, if you're not authentic and you're not, you know, like being true, people smell that. Like, and that's what they crave. They want people that have something to say, that have a voice and, you know, like give good advice too. That's really important at the end of the day. Like if you are saying things and it actually works and this is, you know, like true problems with real solutions, mm-hmm. then at the end of the day, the audience will follow. Like it's that field of dreams, build it and they will come kind of,
yeah, I love kind of thing,
which is trite, but like at the same time, it's true. If you consistently put out, you know, useful and helpful material, at the end of the day, the audience will show up because you're going to resonate with a certain section of the vast sea of humans on the internet.
Well, that's funny because like that's what got me back on Twitter was like I had a coworker and he was like, oh yeah, people are sharing your blog on Twitter. And I was like, oh yeah, I forgot Twitter was a thing. And like I haven't used it since college and I had like, I don't know, 300 followers. So I was like, all right, I'll get back on Twitter. And I was like, oh cool, people are sharing my blogs. And that was why I got on Twitter, was to share content and like learn from other people. Mm-hmm. And then he was right. He was like, if you post, people will come. And I'm like, okay, well, all right, let's try it. And I just kept posting blog posts and tweets and I was very consistent, sporadically consistent, but consistent. And he was right. People eventually will come. You just have to be passionate and consistent.
Yeah. My friends, Amy and Alex, have a blog called Stacking the Bricks. And to me, that phrase stacking the bricks is what it's really all about. You know, every time you write a post or sometimes even a tweet, though, those like Twitter's weird. But you know, like every time you write a blog post or do something with depth, you're putting a brick, you're building your wall and presence and overall audience. But it's a slow, methodical process kind of over time.
Yeah. There are people like on Twitter, I noticed specifically that they just want to get followers and like all they care about is follower count. And like, to me, that's kind of backwards, right? Like if you care about the content first, that's what's really important. Yeah. But not only that, like, I don't think people see the negative side of like so-called social media fame, right? Like I wouldn't say I'm famous, but having, you know, a certain number of followers comes with downsides. And I don't think people see that. I think people only see the positive sides of like this internet fame, so to say. Yeah. So,
no, yeah. I mean, and you know, you blew up a little bit on Twitter over the last year and it changes, like the whole thing changes, right? Like if you're writing and it's going to 1,000 people, like 50 of those people actually probably see the tweet, but you get people that get into like the six figures of you basically can't have an opinion without probably spending a day like thinking about mm-hmm. it, unless you just want to be annihilated.
But yeah.
And it doesn't matter what you say, you're going to get, you know, there's going to be 50, you know, like the, some percentage of folks that are going to be really mad about it. And then some that, you know, mm-hmm. are going to be really passionate about what you have to say. And that like puts you in a box, a weird box.
It is.
Twitter's a weird space in general, I think.
I forget. I was on a podcast recently and I was asked, you know, like, does the fear of having what you say being taken out of context keep you from producing content? And I'm like, well, I don't think it keeps me from producing stuff, but I'm hyper aware of how I say things now, because first of all, Twitter, you have 140 characters. Like there's only so much you can say unless you want to write a novel. But if you don't kind of curate what you put out there, people will come and they will rain on your parade. And that's mentally extremely difficult. And I try to be very transparent about this stuff, like on the internet, because I feel like there's a stigma around being like transparent about the negative sides of things, whether that be like mental health or dealing with negative things on social media. Like, we should be openly talking about these things because there's nothing wrong with it. And you should never feel ashamed for having to take mental health breaks from social media or like from things in general. It's a double-edged sword.
So I took a week off of Twitter. I'm a Twitter fanatic. Like, I spend, you know, an excessive amount of time just scrolling, and I do it. It's part of my job, right? Like, I need to keep abreast and see who's doing what and that sort of thing. But, you know, like, they, like, the likes and retweets and metrics side of all of this can be such a, just it affects us at a deep level, like as humans, and triggers, you know, like the internal dopamine releases and all that fun stuff that they're it's a game for them, though. They're playing on us.
It is.
And they do it very skillfully.
We're like, either, I don't know if it's classically conditioning ourselves or operantly conditioning ourselves to like continue to scroll. Like, my screen time, I don't even want to take a look at it. I had to disable screen time because it was like, your brain is like turning into a pile of mush. It's like, yeah, I know. But to some extent, like, that's how you build a brand, and that's how you build, you know, your company. But it does definitely take a toll mentally.
Yeah. And, you know, ignore for today, right? Screen limits reached. Ignore for today.
Right. I don't care. Let me in.
Give me my metrics. So for onlookers, I mean, speaking of like looking at Emma and you blogging and producing and making content and doing the thing, like, you appear relentlessly productive. And I'm wondering, how do you balance that, like, in terms of your life and work and the separation between the two? And is there a separation, or is it all kind of the same thing?
Surface level, I seem like I have my life together, but like subsurface level, I'm like a hot mess.
Same.
And I think like, okay, I wouldn't say hot mess, right? But like, it's not as perfect as things seem. So like, very recently I tweeted about the fact that like, I feel anxious or I feel bad about myself if I'm not doing something to further my career or further my skill set. Like, if I need time to like read a book, which is like my favorite hobby, right? Like, I feel like I'm being unproductive and I get really antsy. And that's not healthy, because you do need to make time to relax. So what I was doing wrong was trying to do everything at the same time. And when you multitask, you just by default are like destroying your chances at succeeding at any of these things. Jason Langsdorf had an awesome talk about how he cut his working hours in half and managed to get twice as much done. And I highly recommend people go check that out, because it's all about time boxing things. Maybe like the Pomodoro technique works for you, but I always have a to-do list that I make, whether that's a long-term one or like day to day. I also like to time box my tasks as much as I can, because we have this like finite amount of like flow state that Jason talks about. If you go listen to his talk, the amount of flow state that you can have, whether that's like 45 minutes or 60 minute sessions to focus on one task, turn off all your notifications. And yeah, so instead of trying to focus on all these things at once, I'm like, all right, well, I need to learn German, so I'll do that 2 days a week during my lunch break, right? Okay, so that's taken care of. And then maybe Tuesdays and Thursdays I work on my coding coach thing, or maybe I get up 15 minutes earlier and like do some open source grooming. So I would recommend focus on 1 to 2 main things and focus on them until they're done. And that could take a week, that could take, you know, months. But try not to multitask. And when you're really trying to work, turn off notifications. Cause like, I got to tell you, I turned off all notifications on my phone. I set do not disturb on my laptop. And like, I just try to get things done. But when you time box yourself, I feel like it's almost kind of a challenge, right? Like, if I don't put a time box on something, I'll spend all day like screwing around, for lack of a better term. Like, I'll get distracted, like I'll go on YouTube. But if I know I have 60 minutes to do a task, like, I just kick butt and I get it done. So while superficially it looks like I have it all together, it's something I continually struggle with. And you've got to consciously make an effort to keep being productive and but also make sure you schedule time to relax, because you will burn out.
Yeah. I left my phone at the office, basically. Like, I took a week off from work and then also left my phone at the office. Like, that was the one approach I took. Just, it's so hard. Like, if it sits there, like, how do you not pick it up? Like, it buzzes at you. Like, what are you going to do?
Right.
I've also been trying bullet journaling, which I think feels like a big portion of the internet is doing it right now. That guy's making a lot of money, mm-hmm. Which has been working, just, you know, using paper and trying to figure out what it is I'm actually trying to do and prioritize and figure out what the real kind of essentials are of what I need to get done, which helps. But, you know, like, it's a constant struggle. There's so much choice. There's so many things to learn. There's so many things to do.
Yeah, for sure. I always wanted to try bullet journaling, but I'm that kind of person that, like, I hate my handwriting and everything has to look perfect. And if it, I don't like the way it looks, I'll throw it out and rewrite it, which got me into a lot of trouble in school because I like focused too much on like rewriting my own stuff and not enough time on studying.
Just for the aesthetic.
Did you find that yeah, exactly. I'm not artistic. Like, I can draw things on a computer, but like, ask me to play Pictionary and I will lose. Is bullet journaling primarily for like writing down your to-do list, or is it kind of like a reminder of like what you did during the day, or kind of both?
So I kind of do the traditional, like the original bullet journaling approach from the fellow, I forget his name, that wrote it, where you're writing down what you're going to do tomorrow. You add things during the course of the day if you know like something comes up and you need to get it done. But then it also works as like a free form journal. So like under, you know, 0220W for Wednesday, I have, you know, Emma podcast, and then I wrote down like the list of prompts that we talk about. So that's a perfectly valid bullet journal entry. And then it has an index and that kind of thing. But then, you know, you can go back through it and you have like a month log and a week log and then every day. The interesting thing about the bullet journals is because people get really artistic with it. So you can go on like Reddit and look at the bullet journaling subreddit and like feel totally inadequate, right? Because they're doing these big spreads and they're all fancy and they're like, they're obviously graphic designers. And that's not really me. Like I like my handwriting, though I'll scratch things out and I misspell stuff and don't really care. You know, I'll just write over it with the correct spelling. That doesn't bother me. But at the same time, I write small and it's fairly legible and that sort of thing just by nature. So
I got to try that out. That sounds really interesting.
It's fun. And if you really take it more loosely, like how is this useful for me, and like go back to like talking about the agile approach, like if you think about this is something I can incrementally improve, what works for me, what doesn't work, like it really starts to make a lot more sense versus this is a rigid format and I have to do it this way. That doesn't work for me at all. With almost anything in life, that doesn't work for me.
Absolutely.
Talking about learning and like an infinite variety of things to learn, what are you excited about learning coming up? What's on the horizon? What are you working on?
I have so many fun things right now. Yay. I'm focused right now like on design systems, which is going to be a huge shocker to everyone listening, I'm sure. That's one thing. But in terms of other skills, I really told myself this year I would learn web animation. So like I really need to get back on front-end masters and take Sarah Drosner's like SVG animations course. That's on my backlog. Good stuff. Yeah. I also want to learn more about design patterns in terms of coding. There was a really great the last talk on day two of Vue.js Conf was given about design patterns, and it was incredible. So I need to go back and kind of like learn more about that. And then lastly, GraphQL. It's like it's something that I use within Gatsby for static sites, for React static sites. But like, let's be real, like I really don't understand GraphQL, so I need to go back and learn that.
Yeah, it's cool stuff. And Gatsby is amazing. And, you know, that's what I've been telling people lately, like get off of Medium, post to Gatsby.
Well, I feel like a fangirl. Because
you know, they made it so easy. They made it easy. I do too. Like every podcast I've been talking about it, and I've had all the team members on because I really, really like Gatsby a lot.
I know. And the team is super nice. And yeah, they're doing great stuff. I cannot praise them more.
They made blogging fun again for me because I have like avoided mine for so long because I didn't like hacking on it because it was Jekyll and it was Ruby, and I do code Ruby and I like it, but like I just didn't enjoy it. Like I didn't like playing with it, but now it's like, oh, this has all the cool stuff that I really enjoy working with, and it's right here, so maybe I'll write again because MDX is awesome too. Like the whole thing is just blowing my mind.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And it's open source. Like I love open source. Jason does a great job too.
Because, yeah, and like, they're doing it in the right way. Like as a project, they're really running it well. And like the whole thing, it's just, I'm definitely a fanboy of what they got going on. And they just hired Marcy Sutton. Like that's amazing.
Yeah, I haven't met her, but I've heard so many great things about her and her accessibility work. So
yeah, she's just a cool human, and they just keep stacking cool humans at the Gatsby. So
right.
Go Gatsby.
Absolutely.
Well, that's awesome. Thank you, Emma, so much for spending your evening with me and chatting. I really appreciate it. I'm excited to see what you get up to. And yeah, thanks.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It was a lot of fun. We talked about so many different things. Love it.
Yeah, it was a good ride. Cheers.